dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. That was Sarita singing Sonny and Frank Sinatra on The Tonight Show saying, "Here's Johnny." This is John Barber live at John Barber's World in Las Vegas, the town of one-armed bandits run by two-armed bandits, open 24 hours unless you need something like a prescription. As you all know, the global warming around the planet concentrated in Las Vegas last week, 117 degrees. It was like a ghost town. Locals retreated to the cooler climes of Death Valley. Would you know that that place was swamped with tourists? Now, as you all know, since I just got back from Scotland, where my son took me to play St. Andrews, I am a golf addict. I'd have to cut down just to be a junkie. As a matter of fact, I've even written my own epitaph. Quote, another lousy lie. Golfers and golf pundits all say, golf is like life. Well, in one respect, it is. Luck plays a major role in its success. On the course, though, luck never happens for me. In the weekly group that I play in, my nickname is CIA. Nothing to do with my film. It's called Curse in Action. Yesterday, on the Travelers on CBS, I saw the most pathetic lucky golf win in my entire life. On the back nine, Jordan Spieth hit three lousy drives that should have been in the water and weren't by inches. On the first playoff hole, he duck-hooked his drive OB, but it hit something and came back into the fairway. His next lousy shot was in the bunker to the right of the green. The sand shot flew onto the green, dribbled down, hit the pin, went in the hole for the win. Berger, the kid who lost, outplayed Spieth by miles, and it only goes to prove that talent will never beat luck in golf or in life. In life, though, I've had enormous luck, as with this show and my guest tonight, the highly respected author of two great books on the JFK assassination, Destiny Betrayed, and more recently, Reclaiming Parkland. He's a widely sought speaker on this subject and co-host with Len Osanek on Black Op Radio, a history teacher at Gardena Senior, where they were lucky to have him, and we're lucky to have him. I met him in Los Angeles the last week in May when he saw my film Encanter's Deli for the very first time, James DiGenio. James, thank you so much for being here and welcome to the show.
Evening.
Did you hear me all right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, because I didn't hear you answer when I said welcome to the show.
No, I said thank you for the intro, and I said good evening.
Okay, good evening, and thank you for being here. Truthfully, thank you for being here. I know that you made some really, really interesting notes about the film, because anything that you have to say on this subject or any subject related to the assassination is extremely interesting. But before we do that, a couple of things I'd like to know, because in the 2 days that we got to chat at Cantor's, in between crunching on pickles, I never got to talk to you about you. And so that I know more about you and my audience knows more about you, could you just give us a little bit of where you were born, your background, your parents? Did you have siblings? What it is you wanted to do when you were a teenager, some of the things that you tried to do, and what took you eventually off into the path of becoming a teacher, a scholar on this subject, and a brilliant author and researcher. So there you go. You have the platform.
Okay. I was born back east in a little town called Erie, Pennsylvania. All right. And then I moved out to California in, I think, 1979. Okay. And I came out here to go to film school. Okay. And so I did that, and I graduated from film school. And I didn't like the movie business for a lot of different reasons. That's a long story. But I decided I didn't want to pursue that. All right. But I did write a screen treatment for a movie about the JFK assassination.
Oh, how interesting.
And then when Oliver Stone came out with his movie, he kind of beat me to the punch, all right? And so I turned my notes into a book, and that was the first edition of Destiny Betrayed, which I recommend nobody buy. Don't buy that one. Buy the second edition of Destiny Betrayed. It's much better because it was written after the ARB, the declassification of all the files. And there were a lot of files declassified on Jim Garrison. Okay, and so that's why I wrote that book, and that's a really good book. All right, now I decided to go back to something that I had a previous degree in, which was history. Okay, and I got my master's. I seriously thought of getting a PhD, but my advisors said it really wasn't worth it. Okay, and so I decided not to get the PhD. Then I retired from teaching about a year and a half ago. And now I essentially do this JFK stuff most of the time, all right? And thank you for all those nice things you said. We publish a website called kennedysandking.com, all right, which we try and keep current. Yes. So that's it in a nutshell.
Okay, do you have siblings at all? What were your parents?
Yes, I have an older sister, and I have a younger sister, and they both live back east.
What do they think of what their brother does?
Well, I haven't asked them about that lately, okay? But, you know, they try, and I'm going to be doing a talk in September at VMI, and my younger sister is going to drive down from Cincinnati to see me.
Okay, how wonderful. Okay, now, what on earth, because when you got around to writing this screenplay, had you ever seen Executive Action?
No. Screenplay was based on Jim Garrison.
Right. Okay, so how did you happen to get interested in Garrison? And you must have felt entirely alone. First of all, whatever made you think you could get a film made about Jim Garrison, first off. And secondly, how on earth did you ever get interested in Jim?
Okay. This goes back to one day back in the mid-1970s. I was going through a bookstore, and I noticed, you know, they had a section of Playboy magazines. And I saw Jim Garrison. I didn't read the Jim Garrison interview when it came out in 1967, okay? And I probably wouldn't have understood it because I was only 15 years old at the time. But now, about 10 years later, I picked up that interview, and I can't describe to you how I felt reading that interview. Because for me, to read that interview told me two things. Number one, the Warren Commission was completely wrong. And number two, the press had done a smear job on Jim Garrison. Okay? So I kind of kept that interview in the back of my mind, and when a friend of mine, when we were going to film school, he said, why don't you write a screenplay? I said, I don't really know what to write about. And he goes, well, why don't you think about it? I said, okay. So I decided to write a screenplay about the Kennedy case through Jim Garrison.
Because
I thought that was the only way that you could tell the story. Because he's the only guy who ever brought anybody to trial, you know?
Well, I must tell you, you say you can't tell me, but you can tell me because you almost sound like me. I mean, I paid no attention to this. You probably paid more attention to it than I did. But as I show in the film, when I tried to book him on the AM show in 1970, I had accidentally read Heritage of Stone. I read the Playboy interview that you read, and I was thoroughly fascinated, but I didn't pay much attention to it until I accidentally picked up Heritage of Stone and tried to book him on the AM show, number one show in Los Angeles, and I got fired once I had booked him on the show. So you and I have that in common. But I heard you number of years ago, and I was so moved by what you said, because there have been, as you saw in the film, there's the assassination. If they can kill a sitting president like they did John Kennedy, the CIA can do in an aspiring president like they did his brother. And we showed you Thomas Noguchi's coroner report. The shot came from behind. Probably the same thing happened to the other people that we show in the film, Martin Luther King. But the thing that is so important to me about that is your insights into the histories of assassinations. And it's one that nobody talks about. And you were brilliantly moving in this interview that I heard. And it was about Dag Hammarskjöld. Tell our audience who Dag Hammarskjöld was and why his assassination, why his murder seemed to parallel that of John Kennedy's. And I remember toward the end of the interview, you said that sort of left John Kennedy all by himself to battle these forces. Tell us that.
Dag Hammarskjöld was the chairman of the United Nations. He came into that position, I think, in the mid-1950s. And he was a Swedish socialist, and he looked at the United Nations as being, you know, the voice of the powerless, okay, because almost anybody could join, okay? And so he was determined to try and do what he could to give these third world countries coming out of colonialism an opportunity to join, an opportunity to have a voice. Well, him and Kennedy had something in common, because Kennedy was very much interested in that. Okay, he was an anti-colonialist, and he was interested in the new countries coming out of Africa. You know, first of all, freeing them, and second of all, helping them become democracies.
Lumumba, right? Comes to mind.
Now that's where they got together on the whole Congo issue. This giant revolutionary situation in the middle of Africa, in which Patrice Lumumba becomes the first democratically elected president of an African nation coming out of colonialism. All right? And so the problem was that the Congo was so rich in natural resources that a lot of the European countries, specifically Belgium and England, did not want it to come free. So they did everything they could to destabilize the Congo. And they did. And so finally, Lumumba pleaded with Hammarskjöld to help him. And so Hammarskjöld agreed, and he sent in a military force, okay, of about, I think, 5,000 men to try and save Lumumba. All right? But they ended up killing Lumumba anyway. Right. And so but Hammarskjöld decided he wasn't going to give up. OK, he was going to try and keep the Congo together as a free and independent country. So then a few months later, after I think Lumumba died in January of 1961, Hammarskjöld was still working on it a few months later, I think in the fall. And he died in a mysterious plane crash, which, as we found out through Susan Williams' book, Who Killed Hammarskjöld, it wasn't a mysterious plane crash. It looks more and more like they killed Hammarskjöld. Well, when Lumumba died, JFK, there's a famous picture of him when he got the news. And his hand is over his face, and, you know, he has this very pained expression, all right? very, very upset. When Hammarskjöld died, he reacted the same way. He told the Swedish representative, Dag Hammarskjöld was the greatest statesman of the 20th century.
All right, I remember that.
And then he said, compared to Hammarskjöld, I'm a pygmy. But I'm going to do everything I can, you know, to try and keep up what he wanted done. And he did. He kept up. He took on the whole Congo thing by himself. He actually went to the UN not once but twice to get them to back him to keep Hammarskjöld's mission going. And at the same time, him and Hammarskjöld had also agreed on keeping Sukarno, the democratic elected president of Indonesia, in power also. And so Kennedy kept up with that one also. He was basically carrying both those two issues on his back,
well,
you know, at the time that he died.
James, let me tell you something very honestly and very sincerely. You only have one chance to make a very first impression. My listening to you years ago tell that story had a very profound first impression on me. I've respected your stuff ever since, and I've read your stuff ever since. Meeting you in person was even more profoundly pleasing to me, because when you first saw me in the lobby and you smiled at me, you came over to me and you said, John, when Oliver Stone released his package with JFK and included a documentary, why was not that documentary the Garrison tapes? And I wanted to hug you for that. And I said, well, he turned it down. And you said, why? And I said, I don't know. You have to ask him. And then the other thing that you said at Cantor's afterwards, and I thought to myself, God, I wish I had talked to Jim maybe before I made the film, because there were a lot of great things that I left out of the film. And I agree with William Matson Law, who said this is the best documentary ever made about JFK. But that aside, one of the things that you just told now with the same passion you told 10 years ago, the Hammarskjöld story. And I so admire you for those enthusiasms, because you carry them with you everywhere you go and it shows up in your writing. But when we were at one of the things I loved about Garrison, because it doesn't exist in America anymore. Wit doesn't exist in America. The wit of Gore Vidal, the wit of H.L. Mencken, the wit of Hunter Thompson, it's all gone. And in the film, when we show Mike Wallace confronting Jim Garrison and saying to Garrison, well, New York Times says that you drug people in order to get people to say things against Clay Shaw. Jim Garrison's response is monumentally brilliant. Neil Simon could not have written anything that witty or that sardonic. And then afterwards you said to me, John, you know that Mike wasn't the first guy to go down there sent by CBS. And I was staggered. So now I know you're so thorough, being a teacher and everything, you're so thorough, you've made a bunch of notes. But tell us who the first guy was that went down there assigned by CBS in order to trash Garrison.
Joe Wirshba. Joe Wirshba, is, if you see the George Clooney movie, Good Night and Good Luck, he's in that movie. He's a character, and I think he's played by Robert Downey Jr. Okay. And he was a pretty decent guy. And he went down, and I've seen the transcript of that interview. And he was really being really fair with Garrison, you know, basically asking him very intelligent questions, why he didn't believe the Warren report, letting him answer. And obviously, that wasn't what CBS wanted, okay? All right? And so what they did is they sent Mike Wallace down then to confront him with why are you drugging your witnesses, why are you bribing these people, you know, the typical smear job that they wanted to put on television, you know. And so that's the way the media worked with Garrison. You know, they were intent on smearing him no matter what. If we have to do it over, we'll do it over, okay? Okay.
Well, when we were sitting at the table, there were about eight people, and somebody said something to the effect that, you know, this is complimenting the film and the rest of Jim Garrison's story. And you leaned over the table, you said, but it's more than Garrison's story. It's a story of the media, and it's as topical today as it will be tomorrow because of all this fake news. And I wanted to give you another hug then. So now, I must tell you very honestly, because of my admiration for you, because you came ostensibly to review the film, that which never appeared on your site, and knowing you would have some, perhaps, you're a jeweler who could find a flaw in the Hope Diamond, okay? That's how good you are. Okay, so I would relish any kind of really intelligent review, even if it has negativity in it, because it's a great read. Listen, the LA Times did not review it. They dismissed the film. They called it conspiracy porn, and they called me a curmudgeon with a grudge. Well, I have a grudge against anti-intellectualism. I have a grudge against the uninformed, and I have a grudge against injustice. And America and the media is filled with all of that. So I forgot it. This kid in New York, his name was Abby Offer. He called me at half a dozen times asking for a link to the film, and I wouldn't give it to him. I didn't want it floating around. I didn't want him to see the film. I didn't know who he was. He writes for Rotten Tomatoes. He came on his own to New York to see the film on his own and gave it a rave review. So
great.
That has no effect on me. The negative review has no effect. But when somebody's a scholar that I admire like you, I was sorely disappointed when I tuned into your site, which I go to every single day, and saw nothing but the trailer. So now I know you have some notes, so let's get to some of those notes, because I want to hear from you.
Let me go through some of the things that I thought that you did a really nice job on. Okay.
Thank you.
First of all, I'm glad you put the stuff in about the Garrison Group. That is a new set of documents that shows at the top level of the CIA that they were actually having meetings about Jim Garrison back in 1967 because they were worried that Clay Shaw was going to be convicted. All right, and you're one of the first people who's actually shown that in, you know, a film or video. So that's really important, I believe. I love the observation you made about how much money and time the media spent on the Joan Bennett Ramsey case,
the Clinton impeachment,
the O.J. Simpson case, but what do they do with the Warren Commission? Well, I'll tell you what they do with the Warren Commission. Nothing. Nothing. They didn't do anything.
Listen,
Mark Lane always used to say that.
James, you can trash the entire rest of the movie. I love you for that because, to me, I love that 8 minutes of opening because it tells the whole story and the remaining nine chapters I try to unfold it. So keep going.
You know, there was no live coverage of anything with the Warren Commission. So the people didn't know what was going on. All right? And then the observation you made, on the other hand, the people who tried to cover up the JFK case ascended up the ladder. Okay, like people like Dan Rather. Okay, Peter Jennings covered it back in 1963 also.
Yes.
All right? So they got their ticket punched. All right? Okay, so in other words, this was the beginning of the first showing in the modern media, and I think you made this point also, of something called Operation Mockingbird. Okay.
Thanks.
Operation Mockingbird was the CIA project created by Alan Dulles to control the media in the United States for propaganda purposes. All right.
The principal purpose, as Garrison pointed out, was to create a foreign policy that would create fake wars, and he included the Cold War as the first great fake war.
Right. And Mockingbird was supposed to support those things, right?
Yes.
And then you name some of the people involved, like Ben Bradley and Joseph Alsop. I don't know. Did you mention Bill Paley?
Yes, the head of CBS was with OSS.
Right. Okay. And then also Sarnoff at NBC. Sarnoff had a direct role in the NBC hatchet job on Garrison. He essentially
I did not know that. I sort of blamed Walter Sheridan for that, who was also...
Yeah, but he got cleared from the top, though, from Sarnoff.
Yes, I see. Okay.
All right, so that was... And I like the way you put in John McCoy, all right, because here's a guy who was one of the prime movers on the Warren Commission, and then secretly, he's helping CBS put together their special. And the public doesn't know this. The public doesn't know that McCoy is a consultant to the program. I mean, what kind of freedom of information is that? You know, I think the guy has he has an axe to grind. But CBS wanted to keep that secret. Well, I would have, too, if I would have been CBS also. You know, and then I think the comments you made back then, after NBC did that hatchet job on Garrison, because of something called the equal time provision fairness doctrine, he was allowed to go on TV and defend himself.
Yes.
We don't have that anymore. See,
that's why
a network like Fox even originated in the first place. Because we don't have the fairness doctrine. If you talk to any of these guys in the news business, you know, they'll tell you that was an incredible milestone when Reagan got rid of the fairness doctrine and equal time, because now it got to be like mud wrestling. You know, you couldn't defend yourself. You know, the news got to be like mud wreshing. They could say anything they wanted about you.
Yeah, and James, let me tell you something. I screened this for a very popular anchor woman who literally almost screamed out loud because she, as a major in journalism, a PhD, she did not know that in 1963 a company could only own 5 television stations.
Yes,
she had never heard of the fairness doctrine.
Right, and there were rules against cross-ownership back then. There was a limit. If you owned, say, one TV station, you know, you couldn't own more than one newspaper. Okay?
That's exactly right. Okay.
But today, under Clinton, and most people don't know that it was under Clinton, the Telecommunications Act of 1996, it was basically you can own anything.
That's it. You know? That's exactly it. Honest to God. Okay, I'll tell you. One of the things that I love about my own film, I shouldn't say this, but this is the only documentary I've ever seen where there is a sort of resolution. You know that Garrison solved the case. He got a conviction for perjury that the government stepped in and prevented, okay? Garrison wasn't interested in shooters, even though he named a shooter to me. He was just interested in getting to the bottom of the case. Is that we put together, you mentioned Dan Rather earlier, Dan Rather lied to us, obviously, in 1963 about the headshot. But nobody knew that because they didn't see the Zapruder film until they saw it on Geraldo Rivera's show in 1975. We put together a wanted poster, which I deliver to the Justice Department. Now, it shows there is a resolution, and that's what that I feel good about. But I want to hear from you some of the negative things that you wish, because Garrison thought there was a shot from the sewer. I had photographs of his investigators in the sewer. Garrison was the one who discovered the guy who ordered Jack Ruby to shoot Lee Harvey Oswald. There's a lot of stuff we couldn't have put in there. Had I been able to run this by you, you would have been able to correct some of this. So tell me some of the things
Some of the things I would advise you against putting in there? Is that what you want me to tell you?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, all right. First of all, Hale Boggs was not a senator. Okay?
Oh! My God, you're right.
Mm-hmm. he was a congressman.
Oh, my right. God, I went from an A-plus to a C. my God. Thank you.
So if you were going to say senator, then you should have had a picture of Russell Long there.
Yes.
Okay, because he was a senator.
Yes, that's
all right. And
right.
He did talk to Garrison about his doubts about the JFK case. All right.
Yes, that's true.
Okay. All right. That's true. Now, another thing I would have advised you against. In The Heritage of Stone, Garrison doesn't really talk about the Shaw trial because he couldn't. Because at the time he wrote that book, the Shaw trial, he had filed the perjury charges. If he would have talked about the Shaw trial in that book, that would have given the other side a reason to get the case thrown out.
Okay. I see. Well, see, I read it in 1970. I have an autographed copy of that in my safe. And I never went back to reread it, but I remember standing in that bookstore and finding out about the Zapruder film and all that other stuff. And that's when I rushed home and booked him on the show. Because, like you...
That's worth watching the movie. Okay? Because that tells us everything we need to know about how bad the media is on the JFK case. And that was, I thought, the best part of your film was when you went ahead and nailed George Schlatter. You even pointed out the woman who did the editing.
Yes.
Your listeners know what we're talking about?
Yeah.
Or do we have to explain that?
As a matter of fact, her name is Donna Cantor. She was the daughter of my best friend and mentor, Hal Cantor, who wrote the Academy Awards for 25 years and who wrote the George Gobel Show. And I got her a job on the show. So,
she stabbed you in the back?
No, she didn't. But, you know, it's her job. You know, often you know that when you know that Alan Dulles doesn't want something, he doesn't have to tell you. You just follow, you know, your instincts about what the boss doesn't want. She was ordered at midnight not to call me. So she didn't call me. But when I confronted her the next day, she cried her eyes out. She apologized and apologized. She has since gone on to be a successful documentary filmmaker. Jim, listen, you co-host with Leno Sonic. I would love you to come back as often as you can to do my show. You're just wonderful.
And thank you.
Sadly, we have run out of time because I want to hear more, and I know you'll eventually get around to writing a review of this. And listen, I don't care. One of the things that some people did not like it was some of the people on the street. Okay, but that's me. I created that when I did Real People because, like you, when I look at television and I like something, I applaud and compliment the set. If I hate it, I am like Elvis Presley. I want to fire my revolver at the set. So I would go out in the street and show people clips or tell them something and insert it. Some people loved it. Some people hated it. But I liked it. Anyway, James.
I didn't have any problem with that. I thought that was kind of neat.
Well, thank you so much. It's called Kennedy and Kings. Where can they? Okay, tell me more about where they can go and get your stuff and read your stuff.
Okay, kennedysandking.com. That's our website. And if you want to purchase the second edition of Destiny Betrayed or Reclaiming Parkland, there's also a second edition of that. You can just go through there, and that'll link you through.
Well, listen, I will tell all of you out there, the two best writers on Garrison, of course, are my guest, James DiEugenio, and the other would have been Joan Mellon with her book on Jim Garrison. They are two monumental classics, and nothing will come close to Reclaiming Parkland, which stands on its own and is totally brilliant. James, thank you so, so much for being here. We are going to have it up for streaming very shortly, and I will send you a DVD for yourself, autographed for your archives, and I would love to have you come back on the show again.
Sure, it'd be my pleasure.
Well, thank you so much, James. My best to your sisters.
Okay, thank you. Have a good night.
Talk to you later. We'll be right back with Joe Satilli.
Great music from all the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing
at last?
Well, beyond the sea.
Then, great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. Go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on VBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great VBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face. Oh, sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome back to John Barber's World, live here in Las Vegas, Nevada, where it's down to about 105 degrees. But the show is going to heat up because we're going to bring on one of my best friends and somebody without whom I could never do this show and I could never learn anything. He is a creative author of the best newsletter in America. It's called News Vandal. Here he is right now, Joe Satilli from Oakland, California. Joe, how are you?
Well, I'm great now that I got to hear James DiEugenio, you know, praise the film and go off on. I mean, as you pointed out, the energy that this guy brings, he's been doing this, what, for 40 years, 35 years, something like that?
Yes, a long time.
It's amazing. And the commitment to it, I think, is what really comes through. And I think that's why he's such a great match to talk about your film, because you have that same level of commitment to trying to get to the truth of this. And I really was gratified to hear that he understood the message that you were trying to get across about the way the media not only torpedoed Garrison at the beginning, which you uncover in the film, but also by obsessing on things like OJ and JonBenet Ramsey, in a sense, expose the depth of their hypocrisy insofar as here is the murder mystery of the century, really of all of American history, in the murder of John F. Kennedy, and the fact that they could just so out of hand dismiss it while obsessing on much lesser issues really highlights really the reason why people like Jim and you are heroic in your commitment to the to the case.
Thank you. In one of the chapters in the film, because he made reference to Dan Rather and Peter Jennings getting their tickets stamped and they rose up the ladder. That chapter is called The Carrot and the Stick. And if it hadn't been for you, we wouldn't have had that chapter. And strangely enough, how this film is blessed, you said, John, you have to have a chapter called The Carrot and the Stick. And when I went back to look at the video I had of Jim Garrison, there I am asking him why Jack Ruby would agree to murder Lee Harvey Oswald when he himself might be killed. And Garrison says, well, it's the carrot and the stick.
Yeah.
He offered a job in Vegas, and I thought, that's how blessed the film is. And you mentioned during the intermission that you were sort of, because I was deeply disappointed because he's a brilliant writer and he knows so much about the case and he's the pantheon. He's up there with Mae Brussel and he's up there
Joan Mellon.
And Mark Lane, you know? And yeah. So I knew I would get a scholarly, even if it was a negative review, but you said, you know, be thankful, Johnny didn't review it because people would want to read the review and then go find the film and they can't. So I'll tell you, as we speak, I am uploading it. I've gone through the process of uploading the film to Amazon, but now they want a closed caption copy. And so I have to dig into my pension plan again, find some more money, and make it closed caption so it could go up there, you know. But I guess it has to be closed caption because America's been deaf to the truth. since 1963.
Well, hey, I mean, if we want to just be a little bit irreverent here, I think the deaf probably have an advantage on the rest of us who can hear because they've been able to shut out the cacophony that comes through the mainstream media over the last 20, 30 years.
And you know, when Merv Griffin left Westinghouse to go do the late night show on CBS and he recommended me as his replacement, Roger Ailes was going to be my producer. And one time when we were talking about the news, I don't know anything about the news. I'm just a comic. I read the news so I can write some jokes. I don't care who's elected or anything. It's just fodder for jokes for me. But he said very seriously, he said, John, it's not what you report on the news that changes the world. It's what you don't report.
And
he was a kid when he said that. So,
well, you know, it's funny that you say that because we've heard now there are different layers of journalism. You have what's going online, and online, basically, it's a banquet. If you really want to find out what's going on and you have the time and the energy and the desire, you can go out there and you can find out. It's one of the reasons why I do the rundown. It's like here, I look at all these different sites. I want to give you just a shot at getting a handle on what's going on because there is a lot of great reporting going on. But, you know, obviously most people get their news through television and through the news media. A lot of it comes through cable news. Still, we're only talking about, you know, 5 million viewers a day, and that's because they've spiked, they peaked, they're riding the Trump train into unprecedented profitability and viewership numbers over the last, particularly 16 months. But you said, you know, Ailes said it's what you don't report that matters. And here's something that's not being reported that really is just mind-blowing to me. Now, if there is a liberal or let's even expand that now, a deep state plot being run by the media to destroy Donald Trump through the Russiagate story and their ultimate goal – the Russiagate thing is just the tool. What they want to do is destroy Donald Trump. Why are they not talking about Seymour Hersh's brand new piece that went up yesterday on Die Welt? Welt, that's a German news source. Why? Because he used to write for The New Yorker. He wrote for The New Yorker all during the George W. Bush administration. And he had these incredible contacts inside the Pentagon. And he was exposing all of the folly of the invasion and occupation of Iraq.
I was reading your comments on it on Facebook this morning. I got about halfway through, and I thought, my God, this is so interesting. So could you expand on exactly what it was that Cy Hersh was commenting on and the additional comments that you made about Hirsch's article.
Sure. So, you know, this is all about the red line in Syria. Now, Hirsch, when Obama had a red line in Syria, if you use chemical weapons, that's crossing a red line. And then apparently, supposedly, Assad's regime used chemical weapons. And then they had the Tomahawks ready to go. There was going to be a massive strike that was reputedly going to decapitate the regime and depose Assad. And I remember that day, I thought we were going to war, and Obama came out to the Rose Garden and said, we're not doing it. And ever since then, he has been considered feckless. The neocons had no use for him. All the Republicans said that he walked back from, he showed weakness because he wouldn't bomb Assad because of the red line. Well, Hirsch wrote a piece later in the London Review of Books, because again, he can't get published here, talking about the red line and the rat line. And what was going on is that if you want to go back to Benghazi, what was happening at Benghazi was at the CIA annex, they were taking weapons from the fallen regime in Libya and spiriting them out through the port of Benghazi, because there is a port there. And Reuters reported on a lot of this arms trade, and that was going into Syria. And that red line that was crossed, one of the reasons why he didn't want to cross the red line is because they had this other complicated operation going on. And the guy who had been in charge of that was Petraeus. Well, Petraeus got in trouble with Paula Broadwell. He leaves the administration because he was running the CIA at that time. And then it turns into the Benghazi hearing where they try and hang everything on Hillary, when the person who should have been up there testifying was Petraeus, who I think was being protected by being extricated from the CIA through this scandal. Anyway, so here's Cy Hirsch again. Now, if you don't know Cy Hirsch, he was the guy who broke the My Lai massacre. He's probably one of the great. Now, he did this thing, the Dark Side of Camelot, and we can get into why that is. I have somebody who told me, an insider, who said that was part of a deal he had to cut to write that story. That's the carrot and the stick again.
Oh, but wow. Cy, how interesting.
But Cy Hirsch is... this guy has got solid contacts. He is a solid investigative reporter. Well, he's done another story on Trump's red line. And Trump, right, sent Tomahawk missiles into that airfield. The airfield was mostly abandoned when he sent it there. It all looked like Kabuki theater, and it was all done on this idea that that Assad used sarin gas on, using air quotes, his own people, because, you know, you kill your own people, we're going to come after you, all that, whatever. So he puts together this amazing story with insider sources that basically says this: Mattis, Pompeo, the national security team, all had determined that they had no evidence that Assad used sarin gas or chemical weapons in the attack that Donald Trump said was a rationale for launching Tomahawk missiles. In fact, the 500-pound bomb that was dropped on a building there that led to what may have been dispersed other chemical agents like fertilizers and pesticides that were stored in the bottom of the building, a building that was a Al-Qaeda headquarters, and the Russian intelligence had determined this was going to be the site of a massive coordinating meeting that they wanted to get rid of this. They wanted to decapitate this part of this leadership of this Al-Qaeda cell. And they were in communication with the United States the whole time. And as a matter of fact, because of deconfliction processes, and that's where Russia and the United States were both operating over Syria, they had this deconfliction protocol where they would let each other know what they were doing so that they would never get into a friendly fire incident, that the United States had been warned in advance that this attack was going to happen, had been told about this Al-Qaeda cell, and had been told that this 500-pound conventional bomb was going to be dropped there. All of that actually happened. But for some reason, this footage came out, and this footage showed people suffering from all kinds of fallout from what seemed to be a chemical attack. Well, it couldn't be a sarin gas attack because there's no explosion with a sarin gas attack, but there was an explosion with this attack. Oh. And the variety of symptoms show things like chlorine and other effects, which means there were a variety of chemical agents, which means it couldn't have been a sarin gas attack. They went to Donald Trump and told him this, and he didn't want to know from nothing about any of this. He said, forget about it. he basically decided he was not going to listen to anybody in his intelligence or national security advisor, any of his national security or intelligence advisors. He actually made the decision without even having Mike Pompeo, head of the CIA, in the room, and he went ahead and launched this strike. They gave him a
– let me interrupt you and ask you this question. Okay. He's informed by the CIA, who everybody says is trying to out him, but obviously they're not. They warn him that this never happened. Now you say he launches it.
He basically said, I've got to do it. I want to do it no matter what. Give me options.
He has to – somebody has to push that button for him. If it's not the CIA, is it the Pentagon then?
It's the Pentagon, and this is the what
– Oh, so he is now in bed with the
– Well, not in bed with the Pentagon. Think about this. He has put around him military officers. What are military officers going to do? They are going to be deferential to the chain of command. And apparently, according to Hirsch, the insiders who were there as a part of this decision-making process, they had their not just their ears to the ground, but people there, that they gave him a banquet of options. One was do nothing. One was the moderate strike. One was a larger strike. And one was a decapitation strike. And apparently, Mattis and others, maybe McMaster, were ready to resign if he went beyond the Kabuki theater strike, in which the United States actually went ahead and warned the Russians that the strike was coming. The Russians warned the Syrians. They got everything out of there and let him blow up a couple gasoline tanks, a couple air fuel tanks, so that there was a big explosion and they could show him a battle damage assessment that would placate him so that they could just get this thing out of the way. This is how bizarre this whole thing is now with Donald Trump as president. Basically, the United States military leadership and the Russian military leadership concocted a Kabuki theater scenario to placate a president who could not be placated by his own intelligence agencies, run by his own appointee, Mike Pompeo, saying, we have no evidence of a Syrian sarin attack.
Oh, my God almighty. Now, this is
not hard. John, just time out. If it's me, if I'm in the media and I want to do so, if I want to damage Donald Trump, why am I not running this all day long instead of going over and over and over?
That's the question I was just going to ask you. Why aren't we hearing about this if they're out to get Donald?
Because the media is not out to get Donald. The media is out to turn a profit. And they're not – it's actually sadly, I almost wish that what we see with this incessant pouring over old details over Russiagate – now, look, if Washington Post or New York Times breaks a story and sources say that Donald Trump is under investigation or Jared Kushner is under investigation, okay, you cover it. That's fine. You cover it for that hour-long program you have or that evening, okay, if it comes out at 4. You don't cover that story for 5 days so that by the third day you're talking about a story that was broken 3 days ago. You've got 8 people sitting on a panel and they're all yelling at each other about something that was broken 3 days ago. But that's what the media does. Why? Because it's low overhead. It's cheap. You don't actually have to deploy reporters to the field. For this story that Cy Hirsch has obviously spent months putting together and enterprising, they would actually have to deploy reporters out into the field to go and verify the claims so they could say, we verified these claims. When you hear them verifying claims about leaks, all they're doing is going and talking to the same people that the Post and the Times were talking to, and they can do that in 5 minutes because they're all located inside the bubble of the Beltway, and they don't have to get outside of the Beltway to do anything. Also, all these news outlets basically ran with the same BS story that Donald Trump swallowed hook, line, and sinker and refused to listen to any evidence to the contrary. And since they all bought in on the story and showed the same video and made Assad look like he was basically tantamount to Hitler. And oh, by the way, guys like Fareed Zakaria and all the commentators from left and right said, oh, this was the right thing. He's finally showing he's presidential. He made the right move. Hillary Clinton praised it. Everybody praised this because you know what you do if you drop bombs, all of a sudden you're president, because that's where we are as a country. And the media has bought into it. And frankly, if they were to go to the story and start to unpack this story on the air, they would have to apologize for getting it wrong themselves.
How did it end up in Germany? I mean, Cy Hirsch has such massive credentials. Could he not have gone to PBS? Could he have not gone to Mother? Could he have not gone to Mother Jones?
I don't know about Mother Jones. Mother Jones is kind of weird right now. You know, he was a New Yorker, and that's apex. That's top level stuff. When you're publishing in the New Yorker, you're doing, and that's what he did all throughout the W administration. After the W administration, when he started to go after Obama, he couldn't get the time of day. He went to the London Review of Books, and that's where that Rat Line and the Red Line, I highly recommend it. It's all about this weapons transfer that was going out of Benghazi. I think
What's it called again, and where can
people... The Rat Line and the Red Line, and it's the London Review of Books. And if people want to get a link to it, email me at info@newsvandal.com, because that's the real Benghazi story. Hillary had nothing to do with Benghazi. It was actually David Petraeus, and it was the CIA. There's the CIA annex there. That's what the people were after. And I actually wonder if Christopher Stevens was there on a fact-finding mission to see what the CIA was doing, and they were uncovering some nefarious stuff going on with weapons transfers that may have caused some people some embarrassment. David Petraeus. So, you know, this is one of the things that the Republicans did, is they ran interference for Petraeus and the CIA on that thing. But, you know, this is where Hirsch is getting published. And you know what? It's on it's WELT.DE, WWWELT.DE. It's Welt. It's the Welt is the name of the newspaper. It's on there right now. It's in English. It's totally readable. Or you can go to my Facebook page, jpsatilli at Facebook. This is bombshell stuff. If you wanted to go after the president, this is what you would do. But this just shows you how inept and how callow the media is, because you want to know what they're really after? They're after ratings. And you want to know what the Russiagate story is? It's a daily soap opera. And they just pour over the daily soap opera. Tune in tomorrow. We have a cliffhanger tonight at 9 o'clock. Tune in tomorrow, and we'll get you updated on the minuscule little advances in the story that we may have gleaned from other people's reporting, and we'll talk about it all day long.
I have absolutely no respect for Bernie Sanders, and do not understand why he is getting all kinds of airtime and print time still. But if Bernie Sanders does not like Donald Trump...
Oh, there's no time.
Oh, my gosh. Are we out of time, Doug? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, I got to bring James D. Eugenio back. I've got to bring Joe Satilli back. Oh, my God, we got to do another hour with these two. Joe, where can they find your stuff?
No, take care, Tom. They take care. They know, you know, the time is up, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Okay, Joe, thank you so much. I want to thank Mike Kim and Doug and Don Newsom, whose BBS radio is just exploding all over the place now. I couldn't do without all of them. Ed Murray used to say, good night and good luck.
Spark of nature's fire, you're my sweet complete desire. A sunny, 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 sunny.